I didn't realize I was wasting $415 a month until I downloaded Rocket Money. I thought I had my finances under control until the app laid out all my spending and categorized it for me. Takeout, shopping, and unused subscriptions were quietly draining my account. And as a result, my savings took a backseat. But Rocket Money doesn't just tell you what you're wasting money on. It takes action to save you money. First, the app looks at your income and monthly expenses and calculates how much you can safely spend each day to stay under budget. Rocket Money also finds and cancels unwanted subscriptions for you and even negotiates better rates on your bills, so you have more money in your pocket. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. It's time to simplify your finances and take control of your money. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Hey, this is Duray, and welcome to Bossy with the People. In this episode, it's me, Miles, DR, and Don talking about the news with regard to race, justice, and equity that you might have missed. And we offer one of our latest reflections on what happened with the election. Do not forget to follow us at Pod Save the People on Instagram. Wondering what comes next? Stacey Abrams talks with historian Heather Cox Richardson to see how history can guide us forward. They dive into strategies for countering disinformation, harnessing states' rights, and how past eras can inspire progress today. Plus, Stacey answers audience questions on getting involved and impacting your community in this post-election environment. Listen to the latest episode of Assembly Required now or watch on YouTube. Hey, everybody, we are back for another episode of Pod Save the People. It seems like we've had a week or so to process the wildness around us, and we are still processing, and we're coming back to give you more news. I'm Duray at DRAY on Twitter.
I'm Mousie Johnson at Feral Rapture on Instagram.
And I'm Diara Ballinger. You can find me on Instagram at Diara Ballinger.
Don Calloway on Instagram at D Calloway.
Let's start with some light conversation. Is that Beyonce is performing at the halftime Christmas show of the NFL? Did y'all see that? Miles, I know you saw it.
I saw it on Miss Tina's page because Miss Tina keeps us informed. So I did. I did see that.
New week. Millions of people to educate. We got a charge to educate this morning. And this way,
I know it's the only positive thing I can think of was
we changed the rate. You know what
I'm saying? And I went to I was privileged to go to a talk in New Orleans at Xavier University with Ta-Nehisi and Joy Reid. And actually, the first question Joy threw to Ta-Nehisi was, you know. I forget exactly. It was something around Beyonce, but then Ta-Nehisi actually was like, it was like, ha, 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 let's actually talk about the election. But he was like, actually, he was like, I wish we would stop using these institutions as ways to measure sort of our contributions and our value as Black folks.
Because of the Yale, because she got the Yale course.
I think it just was also like the Grammys and the music, the country music awards. He was just on some like, who... Why do we care about those things? But it just, it was an interesting place to start this talk. Which was, but yeah, just that was sort of his perspective among many other things, but it was incredible. So if y'all happen to be able to see him on the road, I was happy to see him in the South because most things I want to do in the South these days.
I am very excited to see Beyonce. I feel like I need this. I'm not going to lie to you. I'm not really filled with excitement, but I haven't really got, like, I haven't got hit by, like, the Christmas moment either. Like, you know, that Christmas feeling, and I'm a Christmas person. So, like, a lot of things have not been hitting me yet, but I'm very excited to see it because I know when she hits the stage, I will be totally mesmerized by her, you know.
Mm-hmm. Is it like a halftime show performance? Is that what it is?
It is.
Football.
Yeah. So
she said it's like a football. I love it. Yes.
It's football something, right?
So yeah, historically, over the last, gosh, at least 20 Christmases, the NBA kind of owns that family moment at Christmas Day, right? During dinner. It's NBA games from, you know, noon to midnight. And I had really come to love that. And last year you saw the NFL incur on that territory for the first time. And if you think about it, toward the second half of the season, the NFL is Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, Monday. So they really have quietly dominated and slipped into being an ever-present thing. And the Christmas takeover is very much a part of that. And look, Beyonce is as big as the Super Bowl wherever she shows up. So this, for them to put on a Christmas Day production that probably rivals or even surpasses the Super Bowl is a massive, massive cultural flag in the ground.
The other cultural moment that happened this week was Mike Tyson and Jake Paul, which is about the intersection of race and culture. Miles, I know you had some thoughts, and I have not asked you about them because I was interested to ask you on the pod.
It was, what, did you watch it? Did y'all watch, no, like, actually
did,
watch
I
it?
I did watch it.
Did you watch it?
Got it.
You
know,
I watched it because it was post the Ta-Nehisi talk, and we were at our favorite hotel, Peter and Paul, and we were having drinks and like put it on an iPhone. It wasn't much of a fight, to be honest.
At all. At all.
It was not.
At all. I'm always like really... So what was interesting about that fight, because we obviously just had an election, it felt, but I'm very sensitive, so I was like, it felt racist. But I couldn't, but I was like, I can't really, you can't just say something feels racist, so it's white supremacist. But I really sat with it, and once I really sat with Jake Paul and the imagery, like there's even like these, this really, I think sometimes because of the imagery's absurdist, we don't necessarily bring the proper analysis to it, or maybe even more thoughtful analysis to it. But there's actually like these absurdist images of Jake Paul practicing to fight Mike Tyson by boxing a big black dildo. And also one of the things that Jake Paul says once he wins is America is back. So there's this idea that, oh, this white young person is fighting the most vicious black man with the biggest dick, with the most bloody blows, and he's able to win them. So it's really that symbolic white supremacist power victory that was there. Something to be shared on these incel Reddit forums, something to be shared between these kind of fascist far-right Trump YouTubers. It's just more fodder for that scene. And I think sometimes because some of us are so unplugged from that scene, we don't always know that we're being used for that scene. Like, for instance, my dear Rosie Perez was commentating, and I'm like, if we only read a few more feminist theory books, we might be looking at this moment a tad more critically. Yeah, so those are my thoughts about the fight, but I'm glad that Mike Tyson feels good about it.
Yeah, the whole thing felt very gross to me, and I'm a big boxing guy, and as a Negro of a certain age, Mike Gerard Tyson from Brownsville, Brooklyn, is one of our true heroes in the world. Rape conviction notwithstanding, you know, and that is a wild set of circumstances around that, that as an older person, it makes you begin to balance your thoughts between believe all women and, you know, this extraordinarily dangerous muck he was in as a very young man. But we love Mike Tyson. And it felt very gross. It felt unsportsmanlike. And if you're into boxing, then sportsmanship and the Queen de Marquis de Sade rules are very much, you know, top of mind. It just didn't feel good. And I think, Sibling Miles, you did a wonderful job of explaining to us who are somewhat conscious of critical race theory and, you know, just advanced thought on these matters. That was a very good elucidation of why it felt gross, you know? And I did very much hear Jake Paul say at the end, it feels like America's back. And it was basically MAGA without a MAGA hat or saying Trump. But it's just, the whole thing felt really gross. But then again, the whole thing was microcosmic of kind of who we've become in America. For the right price, I guess everything's okay, right? Everything goes for the right price. I'm just glad Mike didn't get hurt. And I thought that was very much a possibility. But Jake Paul still hasn't fought a real fighter in my book as a boxing man.
I was surprised to see Jake Paul box the black dildo. Like, it was such a clear, like, sexual racist. It, like, it wasn't, you didn't have to like think deep about it. I was like, oh, this is a thing. This is, and to do it publicly, like, it wasn't like somebody leaked the video. That was actually what, I mean, I'll talk about this in my news, but that's actually what surprised me, is how much the incel crowd has just normalized what would have simply been unacceptable before, is shocking to me.
I guess I also think about this in a very elementary way. Mike Tyson, what is left of him? This man who gets enjoyment from spending time with pigeons. Just let him alone. At this point, I don't want to go back down memory road. He, like, yes, down to your point around the convict, like, he, hero maybe in some respects in terms of like how this young man grew up, but like the level of trauma that he has suffered through and has then inflicted on others, it's sort of like, let him alone in that pigeon coop and let's be done with it. I just feel like, I guess it's also just coming off of this campaign and really trying to identify like our Black heroes. Like, I just want us to spend time and investment on those that actually can help to take our community some places. And I mean everybody. I mean everybody from Sexy Red to Hakeem Jeffries. Like, how
Sexy Red gets so many.
How can we, like, how? But I just want to take everybody that we can actually do something with, and let's put our arms around them and figure out how we can move our people forward. I guess, like, going back into the cultural sort of zeitgeisty Black hat and pulling out Mike Tyson.
Well, he's, I mean, what
I just don't want it. I don't want it. I don't care how much. I don't care what the price is. I just don't. I don't want it.
What made me feel better, Auntie Diarra, is this is before, like, in the middle of it. I think sometimes we have a tendency, or I'll speak for myself. I have the tendency to Cicely Tyson wash a lot of Black people because they reached over the age of 50. And when I really thought about Mike Tyson, I said, he bit off a nigga's ear. Excuse me, I'm sorry. I was like, he was talking about with Robin Givens, talking smack with Barbara. Like, he has had some of the most absurdist moments in mainstream. So if you really dig in the like great treasure trove of Black cultural moments and what is appropriate for the absurdity of 2024 and like this like new second wave of Trump era, he is our Negro. Like he is the moment. He matches it. But I think sometimes when we get over 50, we over here be like, well, didn't he walk with King?
Yeah,
and wasn't he talking right to Malcolm? And wasn't he friends with Muhammad Ali? It's like, no, that wasn't him. He was a mess.
When I was in my very young, fine days in my 20s, I was approached by Mike Tyson. And when I tell you, it was the most terrifying thing of my life, to be honest.
I thought you were going
to
say, that's how come I'm a lesbian now.
Oh my God, Miles, Lord Jesus.
Okay. Might have something to do with it. Okay.
Might have something here. Y'all are. Wow. Look. So I'll segue that into my news. My news is about how teachers have been dealing with the election. And actually, shout out to one of our listeners, Shaquise, who actually sent me this because I hadn't seen it. And he was like, I listened to the pod. What do you think about this news? I'm like, I'm going to put this up. So generally, it's about, they're different than last time Trump won, that there's sort of a chilling effect that's been happening in classrooms, that teachers have not known how to talk about it or felt like they can't talk about Trump's win. Principals, school leaders also feel like they can't talk about Trump's win. It's interesting to see also the way the numbers have shaken out. Remember that, you know, on election day, it was like, Trump wins in a landslide, da da da. As all the rest of the ballots keep getting, it looks like Trump is actually winning less than 50% of the vote and is only a percentage point above Kamala. So I just put that in perspective because even in this article, it talks about like Tripe's decisive win and da da da. And you would think that he won 80% of the vote if you were reading this article in Ed Week, which I do like Ed Week. And I'm like, ooh, this is interesting. So what the only sort of data point from this that I thought was fascinating was that Ed Week's research center from September 28th to October 8th, did a nationally representative survey of educators, and 39% of educators said they would vote for Trump. 11% said that they were going to vote for a third party candidate, and 50% said they were going to vote for Kamala Harris. I'm not going to lie. I saw those numbers, and I was frankly surprised that the Trump number was so high. Not because I'm foolish about, you know, the way people have supported his fascism and stuff, but with educators, you know, he has literally said he's going to abolish the Department of Education. And for people who work in schools, it's like, you know, especially if you work in a low-income school, they are all supplemented by federal dollars, special education supplemented by federal dollars, school lunch supplemented by federal dollars. There are very few school systems across the country that can get through a year or a set of months without federal money. It's just like they don't have the money to do it. And I was actually pretty shocked by that. I also, it's interesting to think about, and I don't know if you saw what Oklahoma, right? The superintendent of schools is very young and has never really done anything in schools, but he's mandating that Bibles are in every classroom. And, you know, I'm bringing it here because I was actually really troubled by the silencing effect this is having on classrooms. And what does it mean? And I think this is a broader conversation about Trump, when people are literally just afraid to talk about it because of the repercussions from Trump and the community of people that he's empowered. So you think about Columbus. I don't know if you saw Columbus with the Nazis marching in Columbus over the weekend. You know, city council president, young, black, gay guy, the mayor is progressive, and they're releasing statements being like, these are not our values. And those KKK guys are masked up and walking down the street with flags. And the chilling effect that that has in communities is something I think we had all thought about. I actually just had not thought about, until this article, like what it's doing to classrooms. And after this, I'm gonna call my sister, who is a principal in an elementary school. But I think about the last election, if you all remember, I remember young people being nervous that their friends were getting deported because the deportation language was just so much of Trump's rhetoric the first time. So I brought it here because I'm interested in what you all have to say about the chilling effect. And I was frankly surprised to think or to see this data that said that over 30% of teachers, 39% of educators were going to vote for Trump. So I'll stop there, but fascinated by this, nervous by it, and something that I think we need to continue to monitor.
Well, from a purely political perspective, I think it's very important to remember that since we have only been free 60 years, give or take, our politics is dramatically behind, i.e. we continue to be, we are typically concerned to the extent that African-Americans are politically active or marginalized groups are politically active, we tend to be concerned with the horse race politics of who is running, who is our candidate, and which candidate do we like. These people are deeply ingrained in the infrastructure of democracy such that they have been influencing politically school boards for 50 years now, while others have put millions and hundreds of millions into jiggering courts in the way that they have, or voter suppression in the way that they have. School boards have been an organized part of the white supremacist agenda for at least 50 years now. Mama Bears, Moms for Liberty. I remember being a young state legislator 15 years ago and getting consistently lobbied and propaganda pieces from these extraordinarily conservative white moms. And they can say a whole lot of crazy because they have the most non-threatening face behind it. These small, bookish, demure, cutesy white women who are effectively saying, these are the ones saying, we don't want your son to come here and go home a girl, right? I mean, the wildest stuff, but that has been organized, supported, and funded. Those advocacy efforts have been funded for at least 50 years while we remain excited about candidates, right? And so I think that the actual political organization around some of these things is a lot of what you're seeing when you see educators doing that, because you have to remember that educators' jobs are often pursuant to the whims of these school boards, particularly in these smaller counties and communities in flyover states. And they are, frankly, as politically, teachers are as politically influenceable as is every other section of the American electorate. But that white supremacist, heteronormative, sexist attitude has been ingrained politically by organization and school boards for at least 50 years. And by the way, that's before I was born.
It's interesting, Dre, because I feel like even the demographics around teachers, like what is the racial demographic of those teachers that, first of all, were being surveyed? Because one, we know that we need more Black teachers, right? Particularly more Black men teachers. So that's something that's floating around in my head. And then the other thing is sort of, you know, some of the text messages floating around in... It's Powell's family. It ain't mine. It's Powell's family. And Powell's family was, you know, well, we're really concerned now about undocumented people being deported. But it was like, but some of y'all voted for Trump. But yes, we're concerned that, you know, but it's only supposed to be criminals, dangerous criminals that are deported, not like our nannies, our housekeepers, our, you know, all the other people that are being hired to do or so many things. So I think it's just an interesting sort of construct. I think the immigration thing, we actually didn't give it sort of enough space, because I think what's also happening in schools is this issue, right? And I think it's coming up for educators. I think it's coming up for students. I think the students, obviously, their parents have all of these sort of values and sort of conversation happening at home, they bring it to school. And so I think a lot of sort of the Trumpiness in schools is sort of symptomatic of that. But I think it will be interesting to see, because I think it also was announced that Trump is going to use like the military to help with these mass deportations. Like, how are these folks that were like, I'm an immigrant, but not that kind of immigrant, How is that going to play out now when this shit gets really real and when it does start to impact students, because it's going to be the parents of students and maybe some students themselves? I think it's going to be a really interesting and frightening sort of landscape when all of this stuff gets going. And I think the question for me, both as a Black person and, you know, Black and Mexican, but also just like a human being, is really conditioning myself to not actually to not have conditions on how I want to be helpful or supportive. Because I think right now, like, I'm mad still, because I'm like, what? And now y'all are second guessing what you did. But I can't sort of continue to have that mentality when shit hits the fan, because I just has to be like a, sort of a human reaction first, as opposed to this conditioned reaction.
And yeah, just to, I know Miles and Donna are going to go, just as a point of information on what you just said, two things. I was talking to somebody about the deportation thing is interesting, because people are like, it'll be illegal. And I'm like, you won't be able to sue Trump from Mexico or Cuba, or, you know, they had floated the idea that they're going to put all the deported people in Rwanda. It won't matter. By the time they have flown you to Rwanda, the legal process will not matter. You will be far away from a court or a filing. It's going to be a wrap. And the second thing that is scary, you know, there are 19,000 police departments in the United States. The federal government controls less than 100. What the federal government does have is border patrol. And most people don't know that the law allows for border patrol to patrol 100 miles around the American border. 2 out of 3 people that live in this country live 100 miles, within 100 miles of the American border. If he mobilized Border Patrol to go into neighborhoods, it would be unprecedented, but not illegal. The law allows for. We only see it at the Mexican border is sort of where people think about it. But New York, Maine, the Midwest, you know, like 100 miles is a lot of space. If you just take the American border and go in, that is most of the United States in terms of where people live.
My Lord, I'm going back to St. Louis where I'm safe.
Goodness.
I think the other piece of this is that we don't talk about, and this is sort of like, takes us somewhere else, but just because I've spent time in Arizona and in places like Tucson, where like, the other thing we don't talk about the border is how indigenous people actually go back and forth across the border, and actually like their way of life, but also like their livelihood it literally is about, and culturally it's tracking back and forth, back and forth. But what happens is with border crisis, or whatever you want to call what's about to happen, when a border closes, they don't tell you, they don't send you an email being like, the border's closed today. Like, you get there with all of your things to sell on the other side, and it's just closed. You get there with all of your sort of, you know, if it's a ceremony that's happening or a funeral or whatever it is, you get there and it's closed. So it's also just like our sort of like the American understanding and psyche around our borders. Like, our borders are like, people aren't, direct to your point, people are living there. These are places where people live and have lived for thousands of years.
Just listening to this, reading this article made me think about just the radical potential of public schools and of schools in general, and made me think about, so for a lot of people, I would assume 2000 was like a really big year, but I would like, you know, argue to say probably for like people who are millennials, like my age, that was a really big year because that was the year between Bush and Al Gore. And then the following year was 9/11. And the reason why I bring both of those instances up is because those are both huge moments. Well, there's a third moment, because when they changed the Confederate flag to the new Georgia flag, that was a huge thing. And then the hanging chad, and I remember people, teachers arguing with each other, like, in front of us, or you could tell, I'm like, oh, okay, the lunch ladies are a little pissed off at each other right now. I remember that happening, and I also remember some students being a little bit activated, not knowing what they were being activated by, but just saying some things where I'm like, that's not how my mom would talk about Bush, but you seem like to think that he's Santa, and that's not how my mom reported it. And then, of course, 9/11, we all know what happened there. I bring all those situations up is because I experienced those things all in school. And I think the potential of school did not receive that, but I think the potential of school is really helping children process what the world is around them in a responsible, intellectual way. So when something this big happens in the world, school to me is a good safe haven to be able to process things, and process things with people who are not like you, who do not agree. But there's something powerful that I think that can happen, is if somebody is conservative and somebody is the liberal, or if a kid is scared and another kid is not, there is an empathy that is created that may actually enlighten somebody. You know, you might come from a Trump family and you love Trump and you love Hulk Hogan and it's all good. And we just love our John Deere, but we're not racist. And that's all great. But then when you really have a conversation and you see your classmate cry and you see them being impacted, that is both intellectually and emotionally changing. So not being able to speak about those things is really sad to me, because I think public schools are one of the few places, or excuse me, schools in general, I'm sorry, but schools in general are some of the few places where that can happen now that everything's so class stratified and we order our laundry and our food and nobody talks to each other and please wear a mask. Yeah. So I'm like, where are people talking and engaging, and specifically children? And this is the place, and they're too scared to really have the conversation that can really change their lives, in my opinion.
Well, my best friend, who lives in Kendall, which is South Miami, a day before the election, and her daughter's fourth grade class, they had a mock election where it was Donald Trump against Kamala Harris. Now, my niece is in, it's a predominantly Latino school, probably Cuban. So those are the politics. She's Black and Salvadorian. And she was one of, I think, a handful of kids, if that, that voted for Kamala Harris. So it ended up being a very scary day at school for her. And I think Miles, to your point, I think it the conversations should be happening in classrooms, but they're not happening in an empathetic sort of let's learn more about each other kind of way. And it also spills over into like her Girl Scout troop. Like her like social things as a kid are now completely sort of informed and impacted by the politics of the Latino community in South Florida.
To both of your points that I think is so fascinating, and DR, I didn't even think about the social, the clubs, the sports, all the stuff that kids have to go to, that this comes up, is that this to me feels rooted in what has happened where we are now negotiating what's true or not. And in classrooms, we actually just should not be doing that. So, you know, I don't know if you saw the editor of the Scientific American just had to resign because she called Trump voters bigoted and da, 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 something like that. So she resigns. And you're like, I think about my time in the classroom. It's like bigotry actually has a definition. Bigotry is not, it's not like a made up word. It is a word with a definition that is a prejudice against groups of people. That is what it is. So the question becomes, can you name examples where Donald Trump said things that are bigoted? Like that is what students should be trained to do. And you know, we can debate about it and da-da-da, but the idea that a teacher says, hey, was this bigotry or not, and they get fired is nuts. The fact that the editor of a major publication, like, she knows what the word bigotry means. If somebody had to challenge her and say, give me five examples, she would have them. But again, you know, mind you, they're saying Haitian people are eating cats and dogs and it is normal. But you are using a word that actually has a definition that is true and has meaning. And that's where I get worried about. I'm actually interested in, as a parent of two kids who are in middle school, right? Are they both in middle school?
10th and 7th.
Oh, middle and high.
And middle and high. And they are very much both in the big, nice white suburban, but kind of racially mixed. They're in the big amalgamated, like, white public school, right? This is the one, right? That if you got to go to public school, this is the fever dream, if you will, right? Of where you're trying to be. So yes, you want my parental perspective. What is the question? How do I feel about schools?
What was it like for them? What was the election like for them as they processed it? Or their peers or their teachers?
That's a very good question. And I think that, from what I've gathered from them, their friends, even their white ones, either voted for Kamala or they know not to go there saying they voted for Trump. I noticed about, like, we moved into this district almost 4 years ago. And so that made me, a third grader and a sixth grader at the time. And they were very interested in this notion that you could be, their words, not mine, you could be canceled for misgendering their classmates. And so they were giving me all the pronouns. And this is very, very early in their tenure in this suburban Maryland school district. And so I think that this district has this ethos where kids very much know what is socially acceptable and is not. And Trumpism is not socially acceptable, so to the extent that they think that ain't none of these white folks voted for Trump. And it's kind of an innocent, you know, cute thing that they think that. It's kind of curious that the kids have not expressed that their parents voted for Trump, or some of them proudly expressed that their parents voted for Kamala. But by the numbers, right, in a multiracial school district in suburban Maryland, some of y'all voted for Trump and some of y'all know not to say it. And I think that is kind of the very non-scientific data that I've gotten from not only living in the neighborhood, but having my kids return. But it's just that thing. And the reality of that is it's like a faux safety. So my kids go there from day one, 4 years ago, and they know not to misgender anybody. But still, a whole lot of y'all voted, and they know not to say they voted for Trump, but a whole lot of y'all did. So it's this topical, very surface level safety that doesn't represent real safety for any of our kids, particularly those from marginalized communities or Black communities, queer communities, et cetera. And so you wonder, even in this progressive blue state, is being around this level of upper middle class whiteness ever a true safe space, or have they mastered the totems of safety?
Hey, you're listening to Pod Save the People. Stay tuned, there's more to come.
So my news is not really news, but it's more of a survival guide or a roadmap, if you will, for the way forward. I like what you said, DeRay, that we're out of processing mode, or we're trying to kick ourselves out of processing mode and jumpstart into, you know, education and let's deal with this thing mode. My great friend, Karen Hunter, who has the Karen Hunter Show, she posted a, this is weird that my news is coming from a meme list, but it kind of is. She posted a list of things that she says are a pretty solid road plan that came from Bernice King, Dr. King's daughter, of course, on how to survive this thing. It's a 10 item list. You can go to Karen Hunter Show on her IG or my IG story and see it. But it's just 10 simple steps. Don't ever use his name. 45 will do. Remember, this is a regime and he is not acting alone. That is a very, very good point. Do not argue with those who support him. It doesn't work. Focus on his policies, not his orangeness and his mental state. Keep your message positive. They want everybody to be angry and fearful because this is the soil from which their darkest policies will grow. Mm-hmm. Number six is no more helpless / hopeless talk. Number seven, support artists and their art. Number eight, be careful to not spread fake news. Always check it. Number nine, take care of yourselves. And number 10 is resist. And, you know, none of that is about policy. None of that is about wrangling with various electoral metrics and voter geography and age and range. It's just about doing the basic things that recognize humanity. And also, it kind of reminds us, as he's making these crazy ass appointments and he's announcing these crazy plans, and you're like, wow, he's actually going to go through with this stuff. Yes, but the power is in us. I spent a lot of time since the election in the old country between Alabama and St. Louis just to, you know, connect with real people again. And, you know, my dad, in all of his aging Southern Black man wisdom, is like, hey, man, you know, I see them making these appointments and they doing this and talking about that, but, and they think they done bought this thing. I don't think it's going to go how they think it's going to go. And you know what? And he understands all of the human nature and politics the same way we do, with none of the academics. And he's saying people have it in them, the capacity to resist. People have it in us, the capacity to build community and build safe spaces for ourselves. People have the capacity in themselves to recognize evil and simply not roll over and comply. And you can get into a very dark space when you think about, man, the Department of Government Efficiency and these people have bought everything and all these contracts and the world is going to be privatized and normal people are going to be shut out. Yeah, but I don't think it's going to go how they think it's going to go. Right. And that is a simple statement, but I find some power and solace in that. Also recognizing that we have survived these times before. So I just thought this list was a really kind of simple but substantive way to determine how we can go forward. I'm part of the problem by saying his name every segment on MSNBC. Right. I'm still trying to find the way to stay informed while not participating in the 24-hour, every minute of every day hamster wheel of terror in the guise of informing folks. So I just believe in our capacity to find a way to survive within ourselves. And I think that if we all kind of commit to doing that, then it ain't going to go how he thinks it's going to go.
So this list, I saw the list online and I saw it when you posted it. And I like the list. The only thing I'd add is that part of their project is rooted in making you second guess yourself about what you believe and know to be true.
Yes.
And
yes.
We can't stop just like trusting. I think Matt Gaetz is a great example. Matt Gaetz is nominated for Secretary of Defense. Now, he is as qualified as, you know, somebody I met in a bodega this morning. He don't know. He knows nothing about defense, not qualified to be the secretary. Is under investigation for sexual assault by the House, all these things. And it is being presented as like a really normal nomination. Like they are, you know, the Republicans are privately pushing back, saying that they're not going to let it be a recess appointment. The leader of the Senate on the Republican side is publicly saying that they should not, that the committee should not release the investigation into Matt Gaetz. Like all of these things, and if this was a Democrat or a Black person, it would be wall-to-wall coverage about Matt Gaetz being nominated with no credentials. I mean, and you can name all the people. Project 2025. I know people I went to college with who literally argue me down. They're like, Trump said Project 2025 is not his plan. you guys are just da-da-da-da-da. And then who gets appointed to head the FCC? The guy who wrote the Project 2025 section about the FCC. And we just can't let up on just saying the truth out loud, even when it feels silly. And I will say, this is the first time in my political life where I've checked out of the 24-hour news cycle. Even I, it like triggers me to see the nominations come in. I'm like, no more alerts. I see who he's nominated and it stresses me out. And normally I'm sort of like, I can deal with it. But this just is so wild that I got to like pace myself because it does feel overwhelming. Even the Democrats, I don't know if you saw that Trump and team are pushing forward a bill that allow the Secretary of Treasury to take the nonprofit status of any group that they say is engaged in terrorism. Which is going to be all us. It's going to be the NAACP. Mm-hmm. It's going to be Campaign Zero. It's going to be the ACLU. They're going to do this wantonly, knowing that eventually they'll lose. But what does it mean to lose when you lock us all up for 4 years in litigation and courts? Like, we will not be able to do work when you have hamstrung the money. I say this to say that there were a set of Democrats that voted for that. That is crazy to me. We should be shaming those people to the end of time and talking to their voters about what that meant. That is unacceptable on our side. Like, we gotta push and fight those people because we can't participate in this.
I think it was really interesting to me that Bernice King was the one to generate this post because I had such like a viscerally negative response to it. And I think it is because this is usually the constitution that Black people are given, either usually not never a meme, you know, we're in a different era, but it's always usually like subconsciously like telegraphed to Black people, this is what you need to do. And, you know, I think it might be time for some hopelessness. I think it might be some time for some surrender. I think it might be time to just not to support artists and support the arts, but really make sure that you're not just supporting people who are going to be able to get rich and be insulated from the effects of everything and have no critical awareness of what's going on, and then endorse corporate Democrats and then be surprised. Like, I think we need a little bit of pessimism. And I think if I can make it like a quick metaphor, I think sometimes when I see tragedy hit specifically Black people, specifically aware, politically active Black people, we react a lot like how we say like Black men react to their health. They'll just ignore it and deny it. I think the good news is I feel like this is so absurd that it looks like white supremacy is having its like, this white nationalism is having this really weird last gasp. But I think the other thing we have to deal with is that if white supremacy and patriarchy and white nationalism is having its last gasps, that means that we will be left living in a corpse. And I think that if you're left living in a corpse, you have to be aware of that. And I think it's about that time. You know, I feel like I mentioned age so much on this podcast, and I hate it, and I really do apologize. I hate it. But I do think that if I'm 33 and tired of that narrative, I can only imagine how somebody 10 years, 20 years, 30 years, 40, 50 years is tired of that narrative. I really do think that this type of toxic, positive, Dr. King stuff really affects me now. You know, I'm like, no, things are bleak. Things are bad. Things do not look good. They just said anybody is better to be in these positions than your Black ass or your woman or your anybody. And they said, who you? You a podcaster? You need a job? Yeah, get it. There's just such an opposition to our progress in America when we think about integrating it with government and politics that I believe that it's really, 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 really time for Black people to stop offering their life force, their bodies, their intellect, and their moral integrity to these institutions because it is cannibalizing us and it is birthing a type of deep disappointment that I think we won't be able to wake up from because we are so tired of being hit upside the head every single time we do everything just like the Bible and Dr. King and Jesus and Earth, Wind, and Fire told us to do. That's my...
It was certainly not the... I think we have to remember that this was the work of Dr. King's daughter. I got it from Karen Hunter, but the list is supposedly created by Bernice King, and she is her father's daughter. And I appreciate the pushback, not only against Dr. King, but also Mike Tyson's sibling, Miles, today. A cishet brother that's having a rough time in this episode.
I'm over here like, let me go ahead and make sure I do not. I'm about to get ate up.
Calling all 45 and up cishet brothers for support today on Pod Save the People. Mm-hmm. But it's all good. No, I appreciate the radical impulse. And the reality is, it shouldn't be that radical to say, F this. We're not dealing with this. We're not giving of our spirits to this. As the great Casey Gerald said in a clip that floated back online last week on Morning Joe several years back, he said, you know, I have no interest in throwing any more black genius toward this question. And that is, I find that very similar to what you just said, in as much as the waste of our time, the waste of our talents, right, towards fitting into this, you know, Caligulan system, perhaps that therein lies the victory and our loss.
Mm-hmm. And I think I you know, I agree with a little bit of both of y'all, but what I've been giving a lot of thought to, and mostly just because, you know, I'm still, you know, a year since my dad passed, and my dad practiced criminal defense law for 40 years. He went to Morehouse, went to Howard Law, grew up in Southeast DC. My brothers and I, when we were planning the funeral, we're like, how many white people you think gonna come here? Did dad know white people? Did he? I mean, this man built his life completely autonomous from white people, like all of it.
Hallelujah.
You know, and I think, yeah. and growing up, you know, we went to black doctors, we went to black dentists, like that was just what it was growing up in DC and, you know, and being raised by my mom and dad. But, you know, even on the campaign trail and just, Miles, people are suffering and black folks are suffering. So even after this black president, even after having so many congressional leaders, civil rights leaders, yada, 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 like our people are still suffering and it's bad. And it's really, really bad. And so I think my pushback with the campaign was like, my pushback with anybody that was like, well, black men aren't doing this or doing that. Yeah, we need to have a family meeting. But really sort of what needs to happen is like, how can we care for one another as black people more deeply and understand that we're not going to like all of us? We're not. That's just human nature. But I do feel like when we evaluate ourselves or action ourselves through a reaction to white people or white supremacy or as a reflection to white people or white supremacy, I think, Miles, to your point, like that's what fucks us up, right? Like it really has to be like independent thought, mind, heart around what our people need and what we need to be whole. And I've been listening to a lot of Tupac lately because that's just where I am, and they killed him. But even in the song Changes, where Tupac's like, we need to change. He's talking to black people. He's talking to us. We need to change the way we eat. We need to change the way we live and change the way we treat each other. And I think so much of that is true because part of this suffering is like, you know, I read an article over the weekend that, you know, America's 70% obese. But when you break down those numbers to black folks and you drive around, you know, an underserved neighborhood, whatever you want to call it, you'll see Popeyes, McDonald's, like all of that. Like, so it's just, I think and this is what my news is about. It's like, where can I be helpful in sort of like the protection and creating wholeness for black people?
I just want to push, DR, a second. I'm going to double click on that and push a little bit, Miles, because I actually agree with your premise and maybe not the pessimism piece. I'm sold on this idea that like new strategy, we need a new strategy. the we fought before, we'll fight again, da, 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 da. Even if it's true, I think is not a motivator, and I think people are tired. I am people, right? I'm still like, I've put my best everything forward. I've slept in basements and got arrested, and I'm like, damn, I gotta do it. I got it. I already done it three times. I'm like, I'm not again. I just want to have dinner, right? So I'm with you on that. I do, and DR, to your point, there is a real, you know, some people literally will not survive if we let up. Like it just, like the reality of not fighting back will be death for a whole lot of people. Fighting back will certainly not be life for everybody, but just sort of laying down and being like, I'm not going to do it this time will hurt people we love. So like, I think that is true to me. And when I think about the middle ground, I do think it is, I'm interested in how we can rethink about political power. I'm giving a talk at the Oxford Union this week in memory of Malcolm's famous, one of his last big speeches at the Oxford Union. And so I've been listening to a lot of Malcolm. And one of the things that I think Malcolm did so well, you know, and he, very different than King, he was sort of like, I want to help Black people get the language and understand just what's happening around them, right? Like this political education part, I think, was so much of it. And, you know, people reached out to me since the election, and they are looking for an organizing home. They are like trying to figure out, they don't consider themselves activists. They sort of don't want to view this as a job, but they are trying to figure out like, where can they go to be more involved than Twitter or Facebook?
My Lord. Yes, Lord. Come on.
And it's not Campaign Zero right now, but I'm trying to help them. But there is, how do we build community? I think the right has done a really good job of using those crazy podcasts and to make people feel a sense of belonging, and they have exploited it to high hell, and we are suffering for it. But Miles, my conclusion is not hopelessness. I do think that people want to be in community with each other a little more honestly about what is possible. And with the left, you know, what's true, just numbers wise, the left can't win without us. They can't. They can do a lot of interesting things, but they cannot, the numbers, they cannot mm-hmm. win without us. It just is true.
I hear you. Even as you and DR were talking, I was like trying, like, because I've never cried on this podcast. But I'm like, and today won't be the day. But it just really makes me emotional because I think just living in a lot of working class neighborhoods, but not necessarily being in the background, it's just y'all. And I hear what y'all are, like, I really do hear what y'all are saying, but, and I'm saying this, I'm blue in the face, but the class stratification between inside of the Black community is really scary. And I, mm-hmm. and you know, just like having like neighbors and, you know, a neighbor who's like, oh, my rent is about to go up to, you know, cause I've always lived in hoods. So I'm like, the rent where I'm living right now is either like, oh, it's about to go up to like $800. This is too expensive. Like that's the kind of hood I'm in right now. And how I've always, unless I've been in New York where it's like 4,000, no matter where you at. But like mm-hmm. that's like where I'm at right now. And then, you know, having a neighbor who's elderly and her going to the hospital and her being like almost like had a heart attack, and I'm seeing the community and I'm seeing the landlord being Black, but then the landlord not fixing up a building next door and letting these old Black people live there. And I know these are just all like kind of like these anecdotal private experiences, but they just feel really representative of the erosion that I'm feeling. So when mm-hmm. I'm in these times where we're talking about Malcolm X at Oxford, I'm like, yeah, I feel really great and I feel full of hope and it feels great, I feel like I'm like experiencing such a deep separation in Black community, and there's just no space for connection. So I hear people on Twitter talking about it, but Twitter is 20% of the, like, what is it? Like what, some 20% of the whole population? I don't know how many percentage of Black people are on Twitter. It's just that so many Black people of so many ages and genders are falling through the cracks. And I think us all, because I'm emotional, so I'm probably not making the most coherent sense. So what I will say about the Malcolm X piece is that Malcolm X saw every 4 years voting for a Democrat as one thing, you know, or a lot of people who are of that tradition see it as one chance to gain power. I think that when those four, in between those 4 years and in between those moments, there has been such a just failure to make sure that we to make sure that the Black community stay up. I try not to say where I live, but where I'm living right now, I'm like, a lot of these places are, could be flipped. You know what I mean? I'm like, if you got $200,000 or $100,000, you can buy this and rent it out and just be up and be here. And it's not going to happen through the government. And I think that is just as important. And it just seems like everywhere I've been, people I talk to, the stats that I see, the data that I see, it just seems like that is just not an option. It's either through this collegiate democratic system or you're going to be a lost Black person. That just feels antithetical to our, to being Black.
Miles, we have to get to your news, but I think that your news is connected to my larger thoughts and in response to what you're saying. I appreciate you sharing that. So I think I'll wait till after you.
Yes, we are suffering, but it will be up to, and not even just the privileged one of, like, I just, capitalism has also sucked Black folks in, and our need to ascend and rise and all of this, like,
that's right. Yeah, that's all I was trying to say.
It's not helping us. Like, for us to view accomplishment through a capitalistic lens that is devoid of community and community building, like, that's an issue. And my daddy didn't let me do Jack and Jill and all that kind of stuff growing up. He just was like, nah, like, we're in Southeast. We're staying in Southeast. I don't care what any of y'all do. This is where we live. You know what I'm saying? And I think it is that. Like, it is us staying as connected to one another and community as possible, because we all live in stratified families. I'll speak for my family. I know there are some Black folks that are just rich. But I think that's what I want to get. That's what I want to get back to, is like, yes, to, I think it's less important now to be, and I've gotten these texts too, Dere, but where should I be giving my money to? Well, what school does your kid go to? And what are you doing at the school? You know what I'm saying? Like, how are you, what are you, spending your weekends in the Hamptons or in Aspen or volunteering? Any one of us can go volunteer at a school or a jail.
I do think too, to your point, DR, this is where the defining, and Miles, the defining the terms matters, is that capitalism, and we need new language because that has taken on a life of its own, but it is alluring and makes total sense if it's fair and the whole thing assumes fairness and meritocracy. Like, the premise assumes a foundation that is rooted in something mildly equitable. Like, that is what that is when it works. But we've never seen that, you know? So when I see people strive for a thing, I'm like, it actually doesn't matter how hard you work, because it's never going to happen, right? But not because you're not worthy or da-da-da, but that the foundation's actually screwed by design. And that is where the capitalist project becomes such fodder, because it just assumes a reality that doesn't exist. And I do worry. I see, you know, did you see the article that was like, the influencers are now coming out for Trump? Mm-hmm. They feel emboldened. Mm-hmm. Da, 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 da. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. This is something.
I did not see that, and I'm probably better for having not.
Don't go anywhere. More Pod Save the People's coming.
News is from Chicago Sun-Times. It's about Ella Jenkins. She's known as Chicago's first lady of children's music. She died at 100 years old. Y'all know how I feel about folks, specifically Black folks. When you reach over that age of 85, I'm not hollering over the coffin. I'm not, you're not gonna have to sweep me up off the floor. I'm gonna be like, safe flight, sister. You really ate that for a century. You did the unknown. Let me read a little bit of this article, in case you all are not familiar with her and her work, Ella Jenkins' work. Children's musician Ella Jenkins, who encouraged millions of kids to sing along with her career, in a career that spanned more than 60 years, has died. She was 100. Her publicist and friends of 35 years, Lynn Orman, told the Sun-Times she died peacefully on Saturday at a senior living facility in Chicago. For decades, Miss Jenkins walked out of her townhome in Lincoln Park, instruments in hand, and traveled the city, state, country, and world singing to children, recording more than 40 albums, and teaching her call and response style folk music. She's been called the First Lady of Children's Music, received a Lifetime Achievement Grammy Award, and saw her work immortalized in the Library of Congress. Of course, it's timely because when somebody passes, I always want to like show my respect to them in a timely manner. But what really felt timely about it is I was watching the LeVar Burton documentary and thinking about him reading Rainbow. And I love Mr. Rogers. And I put on Pee Wee Herman in my wacky living room, just like as like just for on mute, just for it to be on. And to be able to communicate with children is really being able to manipulate where the future goes. And I think sometimes we overlook it because children's art, children's music, children's literature is not seen as sophisticated, not seen as academic, and maybe not seen as important. But I love the idea that Ella was really... she really knew the importance of it. I love that it was based in folk music, a historically Black tradition. And I also love that she knew that through melody, through song, through chords, you can really change how a child feels around the world. Because the main thing that's delivered when it comes to children's music is safety and wonder. And to be able to do both of those things at the same time, to both feel free to wonder and feel safe, is something that really lets people be ambitious with where their life can go. And to deliver that to the children of Chicago is just amazing, amazing, amazing. I hope and I want for more Black folks to create things for children, to think about that, to put that on their agendas. I want more Black folks to do, even if it's a small thing, everybody's not going to do no songs and write a children's book, but even if it's a small Zoom meeting where you just ask kids how they are, when you just let them know that they are kids who don't know you, maybe don't have a figure, maybe they don't have a mother, so you're a woman, maybe they don't have a father and you're a man. I think those things, sometimes we don't talk about how radical those things are, specifically adults outside of the context of the enemy, which is parents and teachers. So having an adult that's on your side, that's saying that there's safety and wonder on the other side of adulthood, is so important, specifically if that person's able to deliver it to Black people. So I wanted to bring this news to the pod because I think it was she's just amazing, and she passed away, and I wanted to give honor. But I just think that, I'm a woo-woo girl. So I think her passing during this moment is also a universal ancestral signal to not forget these type of lanes when it comes to children's literature, film, and of course, music. And the last thing that I'll say is that our greatest minds did know this. So when you look at Bell Hooks and Toni Morrison, they both not just have one children's book, they have a lot in series of children's books underneath their, inside of their library of writings. And I don't just, those aren't money grabs. They understood the power of saying something radical to a Black child. And just to, for example, in Bell Hooks' book, she made it sure there was an illustration of a Black boy sitting. And I never thought about that. She says it, she talks about it in a talk. She says, you know what? Black boys in children, film, in literature, and in music are always kind of shown in action, doing something, but you don't see a lot of Black children just sitting or Black boys just sitting and reflecting or reading or chilling. And that was such an important thing. And I when we think about meditation and the rest deck and the nap ministry, it's like, oh yeah, that is really important. That really is important to normalize in a page of a children's book early on. So sorry for my deviation, but I just wanted to just reiterate how important it is to add that to your creative portfolios or your business portfolios, or things that directly affect children that are kind of outside of just education and the things that we usually talk about children about.
Miles, have you read the book, Should We Burn Babar?
I haven't.
You should read it immediately. Okay. I read it a long time ago, and it's great. It is probably the most famous book that is critical of the genre of children's stories and everything. And what Herb Cole argues, which I remember reading and being like, why didn't I ever think about this? He, you know, as an organ, he doesn't say it like this. I would say it like this, is that every story is a lesson in power. So he uses Babar as, he's like, you know, there are all these reasons to love Babar. I think everybody on this, DR and Don, you remember Babar, the elephant?
I know. Absolutely. I'm like, I love Babar. So what are you about to say?
So he's like, remember, this is the colonial project. Babar becomes king because his mother gets killed by a hunter, which is sort of glossed over in the thing. Why is he special? Because he's educated not with the elephants, but he goes off to Paris, i.e. sort of the humans, not his people, educate him. He comes back, and therefore he is just smarter than everybody else, right? Like there's this, so he unpacks this narrative about power in Babar, and then he has a essay that was the first of its kind called Was Rosa Tired? And he breaks down why the spreading of the idea that Rosa Parks was tired and sat down on the bus is dangerous. He's like, it makes it seem like her act was an accident, that she just got so exhausted that she sat down and therefore the civil rights movement happened. It completely ruins her agency as an activist, as somebody who planned it. And I think about, you know, that book came out a while ago, but, you know, people are like, everything's PC and da da da. And you're like, no, we should actually talk about what power looks like, because there are a lot of people I grew up reading. When I heard Rosa Parks, she was tired. That was the story I was taught. She was tired, sat down. They told her to get up. She was like, no, I'm not getting up. I'm too tired. My feet hurt. Da, da, da. And then only later I was like, oh, that was a political project to tell the story that way. I did not understand that. And the reason, Miles, that I want to just double click on what you said and agree is that one of the things that's interesting as my friends start to have kids is Miss Rachel, Yo Gabba Gabba, Peppa Pig, Paw Patrol. These stories are sending a message about what power looks like. And not only are the kids taking it up, but the parents are watching the same episode 8,000 times. Like, you might not think you're paying attention to it, but Caillou is the great example for me. I don't know if y'all know Caillou, but Caillou is sort of a smartass to his parents. And I know a lot of friends who are like, my kid can't watch Caillou. They're like, oh no, because the way he talks back is just, we can't do that in the house. But it is such a clear example of how people see the way that what happens in children's things come into the home. On the flip side, I know a lot of people who are like, Miss Rachel is the reason why my child knows how to talk about their feelings, why my child knows colors and time, especially during the pandemic. Miss Rachel was a huge part of people's lives and helped guide kids on YouTube. And that's not nothing. That is power. That's cultural currency that matters. So Should We Burn Babar? Incredible book. I just looked on Amazon and it's back in print. When I read it, it was out of print. I had to order from like a rare bookstore. Right. But I'm happy that in this moment it is back.
Please drop the link.
You know, Miles, you said a lot, and there's so many things to touch on, but thank you for the notion of mentioning the money grab. If you look at what's happening right now, a lot of celebrities have children's books. I think you need to consider as a red flag, how many of these have they done, right? And artists, authors do this. This is what they do. And Sister Jenkins was, I'm reading her bio that you sent me and I've read some other stuff. She was a prolific artist who happened to specialize in the children's genre. So she did this for real. And so that means that work is from an authentic, special place, the divine place. It's not the money grab, you know? And so I'm glad you mentioned that. But, you know, I think before we started recording, I mentioned that I love that you bring these news stories because we wouldn't know about these people otherwise, who have contributed so richly to making the whole world better. All of us individually more humane, more caring, more loving. Certainly people who heard her work early on are now elders and have treated folks better for having encountered her. And there's, you know, Sister Judith Jameson just passed, who was one of the architects of the Alvin Ailey American Dance Theater. Mm-hmm. I grew up with Catherine Dunham right across the way in East St. Louis. And these are people who have demonstrably dragged the world forward, whether or not anyone knew their names outside of, you know, their immediate sphere of influence. They made an impact in that ripple effect. But, you know, I would suggest that these are people who obviously, not by any metric of fairness, but these are people who dealt with a world much more dastardly and vile than the one we live in today. Okay. And I don't mean to go back to this Pollyanna-ish narrative of they persisted. Nah, but they found a way to create space for joy and love and uplifting humanity, even in the face of some absolute horrendous shit, right? My dad talks about surviving the Bull Connors of the world, and it sounds cliche, but they really did. But not only did they survive that stuff, but they created this really important dynamic space for joy and for love and for wholeness, probably for folks from marginalized communities, you know? And I look at your wall, man, and you, man, I look at your wall, Sibling Miles, and you have just, you give so much to the world every day.
Man is gender neutral in Black tongue. Okay, go ahead.
Very well, thank you. Thank you for making
now Trump going to chop that up.
Thank you for making me feel better about it. I just don't want to be lazy about it going forward. But I just think that, you know, you have so much to give to the world, and you do give so much to the world that I find my worry is in the Miles's of the world checking out, right? I think you can check out from politics. I think you can check out from world affairs. I think you can divest from Tesla stock. All of that is great, but you cannot get so disillusioned so that you remove your gifts from the world, because Sister Jenkins did not do that, right? Mm-hmm. And Catherine Dunham did not, and Judith Jameson did not do that, right? And so it's important to me that my kids see Revelation at least once a year, right? And it's important to somebody that she taught at Roosevelt in Chicago for a year, and that's what the despair thing. And it's important to say, do not despair and do be of good cheer, because while those things sound cliches are cliche because they're true, because the Mileses of the world can't check out. Because if you do, that's when we're real fucked up.
Mm-hmm. One of the things Ella Jenkins, one of her dear friends, said about her is that she was a person of extreme integrity and love. And I'm reading Edward Dondycott's book right now. It's called We're Alone. Yes, we are. It's sort of a book of essays, one of her essays. She talks a lot about Toni Morrison, and she spoke at Toni Morrison's funeral. And she talks about how extraordinarily kind Toni Morrison was and is. And so I guess, you know, so much of this is like very existential for me. And I've been thinking a lot about what I want people to say about me and what my contributions were when I'm gone. And so I think to sort of to Don's point around like, we, yes, there's yes to the, to all of the things, but I think our interior, making sure that in our interactions with one another, no matter the despair in the world, can still come from a place of extreme integrity, love, and kindness. I think it's very important. And I think it's sort of the hardest practice. But Don, to your point around how Ella Jenkins had to practice this in the 60s and 70s versus where we are now, I think is just an extraordinary reminder that if you sort of have a practice where you're being expansive about your thinking and your love, that this is the time now. This is the most important time to do that.
Thank you, Uncle Don, for that. I think a lot of people, you know, me included, are trying to figure out what your place is. And you just have to be honest about how you feel sometimes. And I think sometimes, I know I'm not the only person who feels this way. I think a lot of Black people But, you know, I'm talking about me, so it's me. But, like, I think a lot of people are trying to figure out what their place is, where is their value going, where is there room for artists like myself, like, and how do you try to be anti-consumerist, anti-capitalist, anti-white supremacist, and still bring that joy? But I do want to just make a clear distinction that I do believe that my own joy and my own Black faith is independent from the American electoral project. And I know that I can replenish that. And I'm always down to do something for Black people. But I think sometimes even being in front of DeRay and Don and Diarra and seeing these excellent Black people, I want to be able to feel really good about my contributions. But then it just feels like either I have to take it all off the wall and make it and make it something else, or I have to put it all on the wall and just deal with the fact that we're you know, I don't know.
I would direct you to two things to kind of keep the art and everybody, frankly, to keep the artistic spirit engaged, particularly in these times. Brother Chad Sanders, I never met him, but he has an amazing Instagram in which he is just challenging the existing structures of Hollywood every day. I think it's at Chad Sand. Okay. And it's just him talking to the camera, walking around Brooklyn like, these are the gatekeepers. This is why they're stupid. This is why you can beat them. Go be excellent, right? And it's a really, really awesome account to follow. But secondly, in 1929, Langston Hughes wrote an essay in this magazine called The Crisis. It was a production of the NAACP at the time. And he wrote an essay called The Negro Artist and the Racial Mountain. And the theme of it is that no great artist has ever been great if they have refused to be themselves and produce what their spirit desires. And no great Negro artist has ever been great without embracing Blackness. And I would, you know, you could fill in the word Negro with queer or with woman or with whatever you want. But the point of it is that you cannot take it off the wall and produce what God has put you here to produce for the world. You know what I mean? And so Langston is much more profound in his description of that sensibility than I. But I try to read that a couple of times a year, and it helps make some reason in this crazy world.
Well, that's it. Thanks so much for tuning in to Bossy of the People this week. Don't forget to follow us at Cricket Media on Instagram, Twitter, and TikTok. And if you enjoyed this episode of Bossy of the People, consider dropping us a review on your favorite podcast app. And we'll see you next week. Bossy of the People is a production of Cricket Media. It's produced by AJ Moultrie and mixed by Vasilis Futopoulos. Executive produced by me, and special thanks to our weekly contributors, Kai Henderson, DR Ballinger, and Miles E. Johnson.